and where trucks can get easily to I-78 with your products, you're ahead. Different cities have different reasons for enacting land use policies. Unger said that a big goal of Allentown's was to preserve old industrial buildings like the ones we were walking through. We're ahead because of our manufacturing real estate, he told me. Protecting manufacturing space is a crucial element of our land use policy. Enough small, new companies with enough young founders would be interested enough in a bargain like this. Ample factory space, low costs, walkable or bikeable distance to affordable housing, to give Allentown a chance at the next wave of enterprises. A generation ago, people never wanted to go downtown, he said. The new model is live, work, play in a smaller area, for which he thought an old factory in an old town could be a good match. We visited about a dozen different businesses. A cryogenics company in which we saw vapors pouring from liquid nitrogen tanks, but whose specific product remained confidential. A polymers firm, bolstered by a National Science Foundation grant. A solar tech company. Another making sporting products from composite materials. A brewery and a distillery and a meadery, which makes alcoholic drinks out of honey. We are looking for high-impact companies, Anthony Durante, program manager of this enterprise center, told us. Not what you would think of as lifestyle companies, providing a living for 1 to 3 people. We're looking for companies that will employ 20 people, then 50, then more. Will they ever go public? We don't know. Our job is to help them get started. Again, as a model, this is familiar. Familiar, that is, in stories from San Francisco, or Brooklyn, or Seattle, or Austin. Here, the model was being applied with local adjustments in an old tech, old manufacturing town. In the late 1970s, the CEO of Mack Trucks was Alfred Pelletier, who was raised in Toronto, trained as a mechanic, started at Mack repairing trucks, and rose from the blue-collar ranks to run the entire company. His son Doug, a tall, lean, athletic-looking man in his early 60s, unlike his father, went off to college and then headed to the software industry rather than the Mack plant. He worked for IBM and then, in the early 1990s, founded a company called Trifecta, which became a very successful business software firm that now has about 100 employees. When he was starting the company, the natural site for its headquarters seemed to be a clean, safe, anodyne suburban office park. Some 20 years later, when he heard about the new NIS program for downtown Allentown, Pelletier considered moving his company there. We were growing and needed to expand. I was thinking of buying a building somewhere else, but I heard a presentation on the new city center and thought, I'm in, he told me. Rather than moving into one of the new corporate office buildings, he decided to acquire a classic but distressed downtown building, the former home of Schoen's Furniture Store, barely a block away from the new PPL Center, and to develop it as a contemporary tech workspace. About 2 weeks before its formal opening, Pelletier walked us through his office, with the vintage industrial touches and fixtures now standard in the hippest work sites. All glass walls overlooking the next-door park, and toward a historic church that once housed the Liberty Bell. Original beams on walls and ceilings. Exposed brick. Wood panels from old barns in the region. And restored, polished, century-old hardwood floors. Ping-pong tables and a rooftop deck. Kitchens plus fridges stocked with wine and local craft beer. He said, I have always maintained that if we created a great work environment, it would help us find and retain great local talent. We could always find smart people coming out of Harvard or MIT, and they would move here. But the odds are that without roots in the Lehigh Valley, in a year or two they will return to Boston. But if we find great people from the Lehigh Valley, who in theory could go anywhere, we could show them a caring company culture and a cool workplace that would convince them this is the place and start a career. Pelletier said that as soon as his downtown plans were announced, he received 6 job applications from engineers at nearby firms. The next generation of workers and the young engineers that we want to hire want to live downtown, he said. The Trifecta building has created a new and great opportunity for all of us. There was a long way to go, but it was a start.
If you've dipped into the world of gymnastics beyond watching the Olympics every 4 years, you may already know about the parquettes. To the rest of you, the parquettes probably sounds like a 1960s girl band. It's not. The Parquettes is a national training center for U.S. gymnasts in Allentown. The Parquettes is indeed a product of the 1960s, and the story of its origin is a heartwarming classic American saga. Donna Strauss, petite like a gymnast, founded the club with her husband Bill. She has clearly told her story many times before, but she launched into it as if it had happened yesterday. As we walked around the cavernous 35,000-square-foot warehouse-like building, the floor was bustling with girls flying from one of the uneven parallel bars to the other, muscling through sets of pull-ups, pounding at top speed to a leaping flip over the vault, and walking on their hands in military neat rows across the floor, in ramrod straight, upside-down posture. Everything they were doing looked impossibly difficult to me. In the 1960s, Donna and Bill were teaching in the Allentown public schools. This was pre-Title IX era, of course. And as a PE teacher, Donna was keenly aware that while all the boys in Allentown had their football, basketball, and wrestling teams, the girls' athletics options were spare. So she decided to start a girls' gymnastics program and asked the principal, a man named Carol Parks, for help with practice space. Principal Parks came through, daring to carve out floor time for the girls from the boys' basketball practices, then opening the gym doors to the girls on Saturdays as well. He was such a motivator for Strauss and the girls, Donna said, that they named the now legendary Parquettes in his honor. The early gymnasts practiced at school, at a church, in a barn, and in a neighborhood backyard. The high school shop teacher built the girls a set of uneven bars. The program grew and flourished during Allentown's glory days, when neighborhood powerhouse Bethlehem Steel, which had produced steel for such showcase structures of America as the Golden Gate Bridge, the Hoover Dam, the Empire State Building, was still providing good jobs for the region. In 1979, Donna approached Alfred Pelletier, then CEO and chairman of the board of Allentown's Mack Trucks. The Strausses took Pelletier to see the gymnasts training in their borrowed space, which was then an upstairs floor of the Allentown Symphony Hall, and asked if he would help them raise money for a real gym. Pelletier was impressed by the couple's dream of building a facility as safe, modern, and exciting as the one the Strausses had visited on a trip to Moscow shortly before the 1980 Olympics. There, they'd seen their first foam-filled pit into which gymnasts could safely fall from heights. Pelletier pitched Allentown, and Allentown pitched in. Picture Thanksgiving weekend, 1981. A fleet of Allentown's Mack trucks, filled with leftover foam padding from the airplane seats that Mack also produced, pulls up to the almost-finished Parquettes building. 200 town volunteers are waiting, armed with their electric kitchen knives, to unload the foam and carve it into small chunks for bedding for the pits. Other townspeople show up to install subflooring beneath the vaulting tracks and under the mats, put in telephones, or do whatever the skills they possessed could allow them to do. Allentown built itself a gym that would become a world-class training facility. I visited the gym on a hot, late August Monday morning, the first day of the fall season for the elite girls team. The youngest gymnast there was about 9, the oldest 17. The members of the elite team are Parquette's best of the best. The girls mostly come from the surrounding Lehigh Valley, although some travel from as far away as Delaware or New Jersey. The parents drive the girls to practice every day, some telecommuting to their own jobs from laptops in the upstairs room the club provides for them. Then they drive back home at the end of the practice and start all over again the next day. The girls are homeschooled, an experimental idea the club rolled out in 2000, when it became clear that the highly motivated gymnasts were burning themselves out, trying to keep up with 5 or 6 hours of practice piled onto conventional school life. The Parquet's program boasts the flashiest list of achievements and all the hardware that goes with it. Olympians, national champions, world gymnasts, and full-ride scholarships to big-name universities. I watched the girls, even the little 9-year-old, carry themselves with laser-like focus on the floor. And this intensity spilled over to a beyond-their-years maturity off the floor. If you planted this group of girls next to a randomly selected group of others their age at a mall and compared their composure, I bet lunch that you would agree with me. I watched the girls in every age group listen hard to their coaches, take direction, request clarifications, and stand straight when receiving criticism. Much of the girls' attitude, you have to guess, is a reflection of the culture that Donna and Bill Strauss have created. I admit that before walking through the Parquet's door that morning, I had steeled myself for the likes of Bella and Marta Caroli, who make my stomach churn even when I'm just watching them on TV. So I was surprised when Strauss's demeanor seemed toned down and unwound. When I owned up to my preconceptions, she admitted that their manner has evolved over the years. At the beginning, the model was mean and ugly, as Donna puts it, adding, "We thought that was what you do." But they grew to see that it doesn't have to work that way, and they've moved toward a different style. Realistically, of course, you can't expect the atmosphere I saw on the first day of the season would always remain so peachy. And Donna agreed, noting understatedly, it can get more serious. So how do the Parquets play in Allentown today? I could hear the nostalgia in Donna Strauss's voice as she reflects on the boom times in Allentown. It was a vibrant and strong city, she says, describing how coaches from visiting teams would come to town a day early just to shop at the flagship Hess Brothers department store. We're still a heartbeat of the town, Strauss says, but these days, Allentown is not the same. Although Bethlehem Steel closed, the Hess store was shuttered, Mack Trucks Company was sold, Strauss says, we survived, we stayed alive. And as one of the newly retired superstars put it in her farewell speech before heading to Stanford, once a Parquet, always a Parquet. In the air. We headed for Duluth. It was another homecoming of sorts, but this time for the plane more than for us. Duluth is the home of Cirrus Aircraft, where our plane, tail number 435 Sierra Romeo, was made. There's always quite a bit of conversation in the skies in this upper Midwest area, where we were again finding ourselves. This was the area where I grew up. Chicago, home, of course, to the incredibly busy O'Hare Airport. Ohio, Minnesota. I frequently listened to the controllers for information or for amusement. Sometimes it was not so amusing. Say souls on board. I first heard an air traffic controller say those chilling words over upstate New York long ago. We had been flying our younger son on a 3-day journey from Seattle, where we were living at the time, to the East Coast for his last year of college. Lest you get the wrong impression, it wasn't a glamour trip. There were 3 of us bundled into our single-prop plane, duffel bags in the back, charts, maps, computers, and a small cooler for big appetites in the 4th seat. We wore headsets against the constant thrum of the engine and tried to stay cool as the late summer sun glared in through the cabin windows. We had flown away from the mountain ranges of the Northwest and through hours and hours of flat, deserted Wyoming. When the sun was overhead, I could look down and see the shadow of our plane tracking across the desert. Over Iowa, we stared down at the nearly comically iconic Norman Rockwell scenes as yellow school buses slowed down by picket-fenced yards, paused, and slowly pulled away again. Over Ohio, along the southern edge of Lake Erie, just before reaching my hometown of Vermilion, I looked for the cluster of islands I recognized from my sailor's perspective in my youth, spotting the village of Put-in Bay and Canada's Pelee Island. We were nearing the home stretch over upstate New York when weather, shorthand for bad weather, began organizing itself between us and Boston. Big bands of cumulus clouds stretched from inside Canada to hundreds of miles south. Colossal, transmogrifying formations. Our cockpit screen flashed with tiny yellow crosses that signaled lightning. Jim reassured us that planes are made to withstand a lightning strike. We didn't speak much. Jim began to plan a route with the military ATC from the Fort Drum airspace we were traversing. He was offering us a choice between a northern and a southern route, and we chose the northern one. Jim copied the ATC's directions, vectors, waypoints, altitudes, frequencies. And then the ATC asked for souls on board. I wasn't prepared for that. 6 years of Catholic elementary school flashed before me. Souls, to me, whispers something heavenly. Why didn't he ask for a passenger count, I wondered, the way they do on airlines? Souls, I later learned, carries no existential overtones in aviation jargon, which is engineered for maximum efficiency, orderliness, clarity, and lack of ambiguity. If you were asked for passengers, you might overlook the number of crew members, for example. We headed on our northern detour, and the ATC wished us good luck. I had never heard a controller say that before either. The vernacular of the air became second nature after hundreds of hours in the plane. I liked the precision of the special alphabet from Alpha to Zulu to avoid the confusions that can come from mishearing the letters. The same goes with some numbers. 9 and 5, which can be difficult to distinguish, become niner and fife, especially among old-time pilots and controllers. I liked the regimen of order as you talk with the ATC. Their name, your call letters, and your location, followed by your request, if you have one. Pilot, Denver Center, Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo, 4,500 feet. And the equally regimented response, ATC. November 435 Sierra Romeo, Denver Altimeter 30.14. The altimeter reading is necessary for determining altitude. It's reassuring to me that all pilots and ATCs, no matter what their nationality or native language, are required to share the same clear, special language of the skies. They do make concessions sometimes. Once flying commercially over Russia en route to China, back in the days when passengers could listen on the communications frequencies, I heard the ATCs revert to Russian from English. And many times in the United States, I've heard ATCs slow down and articulate a little more distinctly when they detect a heavy accent from a pilot. We are always November 435 Sierra Romeo. November, the phonetic version of the letter N, indicates a U.S. registered aircraft, so their tail numbers begin with N. Canadian planes begin with a C or Charlie, and British ones with a B or Bravo, and so on. Pilots don't generally name their planes the way boaters do their boats. No Lucky Lady or Mist Chief. Diehard pilots often memorize their friends' tail numbers. Once, when we were flying over the Hudson River, one of Jim's friends recognized ours and requested ATC permission to go to a private frequency so we could chat. It was kind of fun, a cool kid moment between pilots. Commercial airlines have their own monikers. Some are company names like United or American. Others are more creative. Springbok, South African Airways. Shamrock, Aer Lingus. Penguin, British Antarctic Survey. Bearskin, Bearskin Lake Air Service Limited from Canada. Spicejet, a low-cost Indian airline. Songbird, Sky King Incorporated from Sacramento. Gotham, General Aviation Flying Services from Teterboro, New Jersey. Once during our travels, we heard Air Force One calling, so we knew that Obama was in the nearby skies. Most times, the presence of Air Force One was an inconvenience for us rather than a thrill. The plane exists in its own security bubble. If Air Force One is sitting on the tarmac at Palm Springs or Palm Beach, for example, there's a no-fly zone around it, called a TFR, Temporary Flight Restriction, perimeter. We've had to fly around such a zone or sit on the ground waiting for it to lift a surprising number of times. It gets old, just as it does for residents of Washington, D.C., who are forced to idle at intersections while waiting for a motorcade to pass by. Another time, we heard the call sign of Mexican Navy talking to Minneapolis Center. When the weather is perfect, we fly on visual flight rules, VFR, which means we can fly where and when we want, just as you hop into your car and head to the grocery store. We always file a flight plan, just so someone knows when and where we're going. It feels courteous and safer to me. And we often ask for flight following, which means the ATC will keep an eye on us on the radar display and can warn us if another aircraft is in our vicinity. That, too, feels safer. The ATC might say, 435 Sierra Romeo, traffic at 1 o'clock, 2 miles, 4,000 feet, a Cessna, westbound. We also have a traffic alert system in our plane. It indicates the presence of another plane with a little dot once that aircraft approaches within a 6-mile radius from us. On the display, we can see its altitude and direction of flight, and then we can look out the windows to try to spot it. When a plane gets close, say within a few miles and converging, the robo-voice warns, "Traffic, traffic." When the weather is not perfect, we file an instrument flight plan and fly IFR, instrument flight rules, and follow the ATC instructions on directions, altitude, change of course, and all that. Night flying is another matter. It has cons and pros. The cons are that it is, well, night. The dark is a little scary to me. The pros are many. Spotting other planes by their lights against the dark sky is much easier than spotting them against all the distractions of daytime viewing. The 747 pilot Mark Van Honecker wrote in his memoir Skyfaring that pilots would sometimes flash their landing lights as a greeting to each other as they flew over the lonelier skies of Africa north to south. I remember a Pan Am night flight across Africa, west to east, nearly 40 years ago with our two very little sons. I think I remember right that we stopped in Monrovia, Accra, Lagos, and then on to Nairobi to visit my sister who lived there at the time. I'm sure I remember when crossing over the Congo River in Central Africa that it felt indeed like the loneliest flight through the darkest skies I had ever made. Once we flew at night on the 4th of July along the Central Valley of California. We were flying over the tops of fireworks, which looked from above like mushroom clouds of so many small, spectacular, colorful explosions. There's a whimsical aspect to aerial navigation. Maybe because pilots have to be so serious about so many things, they go their version of crazy in naming waypoints. Waypoints? You can think of them as intersections in the skyways. If you're flying along an ATC's routing, you'll fly along a virtual highway and then turn at an intersection called a waypoint. There's always a little secret or a message or a joke behind the 5-letter waypoint names. Here are some of the categories I've identified. Local pride. In Louisiana, you'll find crammed into 5-letter versions Creole, Zydeco, Voodoo, Rhythm. Near Santa Rosa, California, the hometown of Charles Schulz, Snoopy. Geography. Over the Southern California coast, you have Newpo and Balbo, near Newport Beach and Balboa Island, Jetty, off San Diego, and Kelps and Bayview, just offshore. Sports fanatics. Near Boston are Celts and Bo Sox. In Texas, goal with two L's, punt with two P's, dropped, football, Texan with two N's, coach, quarterback, tackle, receiver, fumble, touchdown. Near Soldier Field in Chicago, Cubs and Bears. In Washington, D.C., Gibbs, Skins, and Monk. Foodies. Near Kansas City are spicy, barbecue, turkey, smoke, and ribs. And in Vermont and New Hampshire, ham, burger, fries. Girls' names, Susan, Susie, Susie Q, more spellings of Susan, more spellings of Susie, and Susie Q. Lizzie, 5 spellings of that. Annie, 5 more spellings. Political Junkies. By Andrews Air Force Base, you find W, Bush, Ford, Reagan, with lots of R's. Goofballs. Near Portsmouth, New Hampshire, there's a famous family of waypoints that includes I taught, I tawa, putty, tat, I did. There are 37,000 waypoint names, and they can provide endless hours of diversion. Sometimes Drama in the Sky glues us to the radio. One August day, with storms scattered around the Midwest, we were flying south along the east coast of Lake Michigan, then turning west to skirt Chicago, now to our north, planning to head on to South Dakota. We heard this exchange between an ATC, speaking very distinctly and insistently, and a clearly lost pilot. ATC: You need to head to Motif, the waypoint. You need to deviate from Joliet. Pilot: We are heading to Motif. ATC: No, you're not. You're heading right for my holding stack at Joliet. You need to expedite course change to Motif. The explanation point is mine, but I heard it in the ATC's voice. The pilot was heading straight for the plane, circling and waiting to land at O'Hare. Another time, we were flying over the airspace of Cincinnati Approach. The ATC was speaking deliberately. ATC: November, 49 Alpha, say souls on board. Uh-oh, I thought to myself. Say fuel remaining. Tower does know you are expecting emergency landing. Verify, are you minimum fuel? It seems like every time we fly through the chatty summer skies along the East Coast corridor, there is some new and surprising announcement. Crop dusters in the vicinity. So old-fashioned and charming. Birds reported in the area. This is dangerous. You don't want one to hit your propeller, wing, or worst of all, windshield. Jumpers, meaning parachute jumpers. Gliders. I always worry that they are not really in control. I also wonder how quiet it must be up there, say, if you're a bird. Motor glider. ATCs spend a lot of time monitoring them and seem to give them extra space and margins. Drones. ATCs sometimes say might be a drone when they pick up something unidentifiable flying at low altitude. Unmanned rocket launch. After hearing this, Jim muttered, "Geez Louise."
Duluth, Minnesota. Our trip in 2014 was not my first visit to Duluth, Minnesota, on the western trip of Lake Superior, or the second or the fifth, but more like the 15th. Until age 7, Deb had grown up in Minneapolis, and this had led her to spending some early childhood time in Duluth. When she walks around Duluth these days, it is with a sense of familiarity that comes from early imprinting. For me, without that Midwestern background, Duluth has become an unexpected sort of second home. In the late 1990s, when Duluth was one more Rust Belt symbol of the distress brought by industrial shifts, I'd gone there to work on a story for the New York Times Magazine about an ambitious mayor and his implausible-seeming plan to revive the city. Duluth's historic and economic rise through the late 1800s and the first half of the 1900s had been tied to the very heaviest of heavy industries. The taconite mines of Minnesota's Iron Range shipped their products to world markets through the port facilities at Duluth. Timber and grain moved out the same way. Early 20th century Duluth had the look of one of China's 21st century manufacturing centers, with all the bones and innards of its economic foundation on clear display. Then the long decline set in. The downtown decayed. Real estate prices fell. Young people moved away. The city looked bad. I went to visit the mayor, a sturdily built, dark-haired, one-time local schoolteacher named Gary Doty, because I had heard about an intriguing aspect of his economic modernization plan. In this locale, far from the big coastal university innovation complexes, a place with a long tradition in the maritime trades, but with nothing like the aerospace industry heritage of Seattle or Wichita or Southern California, Doty hoped to foster a tiny startup company that intended to transform the entire industry of small aircraft aviation. At the time, the company mainly consisted of two young brothers from rural Wisconsin, Alan and Dale Klapmeyer, and a small band of co-workers and friends. Their idea was to produce an entirely new kind of airplane that would outclass the familiar Cessna, Piper, and Beechcraft brands of light aircraft and make small plane travel safer, cheaper, more comfortable, and more attractive to a wider audience. In the aviation world, the Klapmeyer story has now become as familiar as any "It All Started in a Garage in Palo Alto" tale from the infotech world. The brothers' company, originally called Cirrus Design and now Cirrus Aircraft, became a phenomenal success. The most obvious new feature of their airplanes, that each one was equipped with a parachute for the entire airplane to bring it down safely in case of an emergency, was only one of its many breakthrough redesigns. The first Cirrus model, the SR-20, went on the market in 2000, followed quickly by the higher-speed, more powerful SR-22. By 2004, the SR-22 had become the best-selling small airplane of its type anywhere in the world, a distinction it has retained ever since. By 2017, some 7,000 Cirrus airplanes were operating worldwide, the company's models taking off and landing in practically every country that has an airport. The factory has expanded many times and still employs hundreds of advanced manufacturing workers in Duluth. There have been bumps along the way. During the pressure of the world financial crisis that began in 2008, the Klapmeyer brothers had a bitter falling out, which left Dale in control of the company and Alan with a new aviation startup of his own. Although Cirrus's factory is still in Duluth, the company is now owned by the Chinese State Aerospace Ministry, which was the most plausible source of capital when the company almost failed during the financial crisis of 2008. But Cirrus has been the center of a new aerospace industry in Duluth, and as an example of willed acquisition of technological advantage, it has more than fulfilled anything the city might have hoped for it. Cirrus's arrival was part of Duluth's larger shift away from heavy industry and to an economy buoyed by education and medicine. The hospital complex is the largest single employer, by aerospace, by small advanced manufacturing, and by a robust tourism and recreation business. At the time of our latest visit, Duluth had won an Outside Magazine poll and been named Best Town in the United States, outpolling competitors like Asheville, North Carolina, Provo, Utah, and even Burlington, Vermont. As with any online poll, this was hardly a scientific study, but the enthusiasm of people writing in on Duluth's behalf was a sign of its new fashionability. Its hotels are booked from early spring through late fall, with tourists coming from all over North America and much of Europe. Every spring, its Grandma's Marathon attracts some 9,000 runners, the limit it has set for entries, to a course that follows the shore of Lake Superior from the start at the mining town of Two Harbors to the finish in front of Grandma's Saloon and Grill in downtown Duluth's Canal Park. Locals proudly claim Bob Dylan as a favorite son, although that is a fact that morphed from his spending a few years there to the folk mythology of his being a hometown boy. Even on a short visit, you can see that Duluth has not come close to solving all its problems. A few blocks away from its most impressively restored structures, other parts of downtown remain derelict and decayed. The city has the opioid problems that any part of the middle of America does. On the streets downtown, you see people who are struggling. Duluth also has a much more difficult racial history, both with local tribes and with its African-American minority, than its far northern location or the idea of Minnesota nice might suggest. But compared with its situation a generation ago, and with what most people on the coast would expect, Duluth is much more a story of resilience.
Downtown development in Duluth is improving fast, if unevenly. To the east, along Superior Street, there were specialty shops, restaurants, and outdoor apparel stores. I was grateful to find puffy winter jackets on sale in early June. The last ice floes had melted on Lake Superior over Memorial Day weekend, and I wasn't prepared for the northern Minnesota summer. When I headed west toward the public library and the YMCA, it was a different story. There were sidewalk detours, deep excavation pits, and occasional scuffles at the bus stop. Sometimes I crossed the street to avoid these disturbances, and sometimes I just walked past. They never felt dangerous. One afternoon, Jim and I went looking for a small corner park we had heard about, heading a few blocks uphill from Superior Street on 2nd Avenue East. We found it, and the memorial to a little-known lynching that took place in Duluth nearly a century ago. Here's the story of that June night in 1920. A traveling circus was in town. A local young white woman was allegedly raped, and 6 young black men were rounded up and taken to jail. A mob of thousands of white people stormed the jail, seized the black men, tried them on the spot, and convicted 3. Those 3 men, Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee, were hanged that evening from a lamp post in the center of town. The police did virtually nothing to interfere. Teachers, journalists, and local tour guides had talked some about the lynching over the decades. A 1979 book about the events, They Was Just Niggers, by Michael Fido, was published and later republished under a more restrained title, The Lynchings in Duluth. There was a grave marking ceremony for the 3 black men's previously unmarked graves. Approaching the 80th anniversary in 2000, Heidi Bach Hansen wrote about the incident in The Ripsaw, then an alt-weekly publication, naming the accusers for the first time. The piece, called Duluth's Lingering Shame, inspired a big turnout at the anniversary vigil and sparked meetings about a memorial as residents sought a way for Duluth to recognize and reconcile what they considered the worst incident in the community's collective past. The consensus was a granite and bronze memorial, which was constructed in 2003. It occupies a small park, kitty-corner from the site of the lamppost where the 3 men were hanged. In 2013, a scholarship was established in the names of the victims. Life-sized renderings of the 3 victims are set under words from Edmund Burke. An event has happened upon which it is difficult to speak and impossible to remain silent. From what we saw during our visit, the memorial achieved the goal that the people of Duluth sought, which was to create a respectful, artistic place where the public could think about, talk about, and come to terms with the events that had happened.
The Cirrus Saga was my original reason for going to the city, and after my first visits as a reporter, I returned as a customer. I got in the early purchaser's queue and bought one of the first SR-20s off the assembly line. As Deb will attest, the 2 factors that swayed her to approval were the presence of the parachute and the plane's comfortable interior, which was designed to be like a nicer modern car rather than an ancient pickup truck. I went to get that plane from the factory in Duluth as soon as it was ready in November 2000, but I ended up on an unplanned stay for nearly 10 days, caught by a persistent ice storm that made it too risky to fly back to our home of the time in Berkeley, California. For airplane reasons and otherwise, Deb and I kept finding reasons to return. In the summertime, for the boating. In the winter, to hear, in amazement, for me, about people sitting in igloos for ice fishing or roaring across the drifts in their snowmobiles. Deb knew all these stories and could readily add to them from her own experience in a Minnesota accent she usually keeps under wraps. We came back as part of our 2014 travels to see what else had happened in Duluth and how its story fit into what we had been hearing elsewhere. So we asked Gary Doty, now gray-haired 15 years after I first met him, what else he had been thinking when the Cirrus move was afoot and what the turning points had been in the city's movement forward. There was this attitude around Duluth that nothing's any good, Gary Doty told us, about the days when he was growing up in the city and beginning his teaching career. "We're this little city stuck way to the north, far away from the cities." He was using the Minnesota term for the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul. "And we're just going to have to plod along." Doty, who was born in Duluth in 1948 and went to public school there and then to the University of Minnesota, Duluth, began teaching but got into politics quickly. He won a seat in the Minnesota legislature in his 20s, and in his 30s he was on the county board of commissioners. He became mayor in 1992 in his mid-40s and easily won 3 four-year terms. Doty's predecessor, John Fido, had, through the 1980s, begun the city's push towards being a tourist destination and an outdoor recreation site, building an extensive biking and running trail along the lake shore, and beginning the conversion of former commercial dock areas to what is now a very popular retail and entertainment district called Canal Park. We spent some nice days riding bikes along the lakeshore trail and prowling around the rocky water's edge and the bars and shops offering Etsy-like local products in Canal Park. Doty thought that his task was to concentrate on fundamentals, road repair and sewers, and also to look for new tech companies he might attract to the city. One of his big bets, and at least temporary embarrassments, was something called Tech Village. It embodied an idea that by the 2010s has become commonplace, setting aside downtown space as incubator or shared work areas for startup firms. But Duluth was slightly ahead of its time, or at least ill-timed. It opened just as the tech and financial crash of 2001 was setting in, and the place stood underused for several years. "We had problems there," Doty told me a dozen years later, "but we couldn't remain stagnant." The arrival of Cirrus in the mid-1990s was a crucial turning point. "It really was the catalyst for more positive attitudes about the city," Doty said. "If that hadn't happened..." And its happening involved the same sort of courtship as Joe Max Higgins had done with steel and helicopter factories, and what South Carolina officials had done with BMW. "Then we might really have been in a tailspin, and not even a parachute could have saved us." But Cirrus did come, attracting engineers and designers, plus customers, from around the world, and hiring mainly local tech workers to build its airplanes. Related aviation businesses began expanding at the airport. United Healthcare brought a service center into Duluth, which now employs more than 1,000 people. Duluth Trading Company and the national fashion chain Maurice's brought their headquarters to the city. Doty told me, "People started saying, 'We're not that bad.' People would come up here to look around and say, 'Wow, this was a gem they weren't aware of,' as long as they were prepared for what Doty tactfully called 4 full seasons of the year. 'I complain myself if it gets colder than 30 below,' he said. 'But most people, once you get them here, they don't want to leave.'" This might sound like any boosterish local talking about any city, as they did in Burlington or Greenville or even Little Eastport. Indeed, Babbitt itself, by Sinclair Lewis, the classic novel about urban boosterism, is set in the fictional city of Zenith, which is at least partly drawn on 1920s Duluth. But what struck me most about Doty's comments, and connected them with what we heard from the next generation of civic and commercial leaders in the city, was his emphasis on generational links and responsibility, and the way his contemporaries in the city's business and civic life were deliberately bringing along those of their children's generation. Doty reeled off a list of the business, financial, and community leaders he had worked with. "As these people get older," he said, "they backed off a little, but not until a younger generation was ready. There's a younger generation of people ready to take the reins. They're doing it differently, but they're taking over." Who are these younger people? Doty mentioned the man who was then mayor, Don Ness, who began the first of his two terms at age 34, and whom we met a few days later, but also some young business leaders who were connected with one another and with their predecessors. One example, The Benson brothers, Dave and Greg, grew up in the cities and went to college in the early 1990s at UMD. If you saw them in Southern California, you might think they were surfers, shaggy-haired, rangy, weathered. Their sports were instead the Northern Plains variants, skiing, ice skating, and skateboarding. Soon after college, in 1997, they founded, with a friend, Tony Ciardelli, a company called True Ride, which became a successful manufacturer of ramps, half-pipes, and other ingredients of outdoor skateboard parks. They started the company in Minneapolis, but moved to Duluth because it was so much more affordable. They also liked Duluth's livable scale and what locals consider its year-round recreational opportunities. The skateboard parks that True Ride sold were made of expensive plastic and composites. The Bensons didn't like how much scrap was left over after they cut out the big sections for their skating ramps. They first formed a furniture works called LOL, then a kitchenware company called Epicurean, now an easily nationally recognized brand, which together made chairs, tables, cutting boards, kitchen utensils, and other products from the material they had been discarding. On a wooded hillside outside Duluth, some of the company's design and manufacturing offices are housed in a building that had once been, no kidding, a factory producing cement burial vaults, and then was closed as a hazardous brownfield site. The city government, under Gary Doty, and state officials agreed to help clean up the site if the Bensons based their businesses there. As you approach from the back, you think, this is what a Depression-era burial vault factory, which was later condemned as a toxic waste site, would look like. Once you step inside the doorway, you're in an environment that the hippest firm in San Francisco or Brooklyn would envy. Recycled timber taken from the frigid depths of Lake Superior for the walls, staircases, and beams, an approach we'd also seen with recovered lake timbers from Lake Michigan in Holland. Other structures made of the company's own sleek plastic. One whole wall of glass looking out on the woods, and bright open workspaces. From this building, LOL and Epicurean shipped their products to customers in 61 countries. As Dave Benson showed us around, employees went off to jog on lunch breaks. In the winter, they ski or skate. Racks just inside the front door hold their sporting equipment. 10 years ago, there weren't many startups in Duluth, Dave Benson told us. Now it's buzzing. If you saw this operation in San Francisco or Seattle, you'd think, of course. Where else could you combine the product design talent that can appeal to a worldwide market, the emphasis on sustainability that has made the firm a leader in recycling techniques, and the production skills necessary to create a rapidly changing line of items? But you find it in Duluth. Because we just like the quality of life here, Dave Benson said. When we met them, the Benson brothers were in their 40s. Another example, half a generation younger, comes from the two married couples who founded one of Duluth's most distinctive and successful craft breweries called Bent Paddle. These four people, Brian and Karen Tonis, and Colin and Laura Mullen, had either grown up in Duluth or gotten to know the city as students at UMD. They'd had experience in the emerging craft brew industry in Oregon and in the cities, and starting around 2010, despite the surrounding financial crisis, they began laying plans for returning to Duluth and opening a production brewery and tap house there. We probably spent 2 years discussing all the angles of the right business and brewing plans, Karen Tonis said. Then 6 months of fundraising and 6 months of build-out before we opened our doors in early 2013. Why Duluth as a locale? We all wanted to make our way back here, Laura Mullen said. It would be an easier place to start our families and live the lives we wanted. Her husband Colin added, from a beer perspective, it's all about the water. Duluth city water is basically very lightly filtered lake water. It's pure. It's very, very clean. It's unbelievably soft. As in Greenville and New York City, people in Duluth love their water. The water's quality, he said, allows you to start from scratch and replicate whatever style of beer from around the world you would like, rather than being constrained by flavors or minerals in the local supply. I am personally a fan of stronger flavored ales. Colin Mullen said that the greater brewing challenge was to produce lighter lagers, like a Pilsner modeled on one from the original Czech brewing capital of Pilsen, one of Deb's family's ancestral homes. Within months of its opening, Bent Paddle was a business and critical success. Its on-site taproom was busy, but 95% of the beer it brewed was shipped to retailers across the state and elsewhere in the Midwest. By 2015, it was the sixth biggest brewer in the state and had expanded to a second production site, a step that its original business plan had envisioned happening within 7 rather than 2 years. Obviously, I am a sucker for microbrew startup stories. But two aspects of the Bent Paddle saga struck me as being significant. One was in providing another illustration of the underappreciated role of craft eateries of all sorts. Breweries, distilleries, coffee shops, farm markets, mustard or cheese or honey stores. The other was the practical importance of these enterprises in urban redevelopment. Operations of this sort have a bias towards less fashionable, lower cost, more run-down parts of a city, especially when they are starting up and short on cash. As a well-known beer world writer named Jeff Allworth noted in All About Beer magazine, breweries are industrial operations, and they're expensive. For making beer in particular, he says, you have to have quite a bit of space for the brew house, fermentation, and storage, so breweries end up on the fringes in bad parts of town where the rent is cheap. The same might be true of any factory or big warehouse, he said. But breweries aren't like the average industrial plant. They are people magnets, bringing folks in who are curious to try a pint of locally made IPA. In fairly short order, he said, breweries can create little pockets of prosperity in cities that can and often do radiate out into the neighborhood. Pretty soon other businesses see the bustle and consider moving in too. That process was very much the story of Bent Paddle's location in a long-abandoned steelworks on the less prosperous west side of town. We like this because of its great visibility from the highway, Brian Tonis of Bent Paddle said. And of course we got the rent at a great rate. Now we see people coming to the neighborhood who say, you know, I haven't been here for years. When the team announced their site choice, Duluthers of their parents' generation raised their eyebrows at the questionable-sounding address. They thought, wow, that's the shady part of town, Brian Tonis said. There's a shift that's happened that people who've lived here for a long time haven't quite caught up with. Soon after our visit to Bent Paddle and my mention of it on the Atlantic's website, a Duluth native named Peter Hattinen wrote in to explain the part it had played in what he viewed as the spread of the city's revival to long-neglected parts of town. Bent Paddle, he observed, cast its lot in the heart of downtrodden Duluth. Since Bent Paddle has established itself, it has created a dynamo of entrepreneurial activity nearby. What is most important for the city is what is happening very nearby the brewery. A new restaurant, another brewery, and a new coffee house, all opening within blocks of Bent Paddle. The investment Bent Paddle has made, he concluded, and the traffic it has inspired are clearly driving this development. The Bent Paddle founders were well aware of the importance of community connections, both in their own ability to succeed and in the effect they wanted their business to have. Local ties had helped them. One local bank took the lead in early financing, along with the SBA and the local Arrowhead Regional Development Commission, plus 23 private investors. The city government, then under Don Ness, himself barely older than the founders and a craft brew fan, gave streamlined approval to zoning changes. As they grew more successful, they expanded their local business contacts. Chairs and tables in their tap room came from the local company Lawl. Tap handles and metalworks were provided by local shops, and they made alliances with local farmers and coffee roasters for specialty brews. Most striking to me was their awareness of the effect the brewery could have on the city's future. Karen Tonis told me, a lot of people who grew up here or got to know it from UMD, they would love to stay here, but they feel that they have to leave. But now we're seeing young entrepreneurs like them who went to UMD and say, I love it, I'm going to stay, and I'm going to figure out the way how. And I feel like suddenly there's more of a diversity of job opportunities here as people embrace the history of Duluth and become proud of its possibilities. Laura Mullen, another of the founders, said, there are limits in a community this size, but you also see your place in connection with everyone else. We're excited about what we can do as part of a new entrepreneurial wave here. The startup boom is part of a general, increasingly cosmopolitan air in Duluth. The sale of Cirrus Aircraft to the Chinese State Aerospace Ministry during the company's financial straits soon after the world economic collapse has brought several Chinese families to town. During our 2014 visit, Deb talked with a Chinese woman who had chosen the English name Heidi. Her husband was part of the Chinese management group at Cirrus, and they lived in a big English Tudor-style house with a view downhill to Lake Superior. Her son, Tong, had just finished the fifth grade at the neighborhood school and was into football, which Heidi said she also appreciated for the teamwork, what she called the mission of war, the strategy and attack, the guarding, the getting the ball. Her almost two-year-old daughter was in a playgroup with other neighborhood kids. Heidi said her adjustment to Duluth was easy, partly because she spoke English well and she drives. We had seen enough of Chinese corporate housing conditions to understand the miraculous transformation in the family's daily living circumstances. At Chinese aerospace headquarters in the southern Chinatown of Shenzhen, most employees lived in cramped quarters in a densely populated and often polluted city. Now, for the AVIC employees in Duluth, it was as if they had their own country estate. Heidi confined herself to saying that she and her husband valued the family life and time together they enjoy in their American lifestyle. John Fado, a relative of the author Michael Fado, was the mayor in the 1980s who brought the Lake Walk and Canal Park to the city. Gary Doty, in the 1990s, was the mayor who brought in Cirrus and other high-tech firms. Don Ness, whose two terms in office coincided with the Obama era in Washington, was the mayor of the entrepreneurial and outdoor recreation boom. Ness grew up in the city. In 2016, he produced a highly personal, heavily illustrated book called Hillsider, about growing up as an idealistic pastor's son in the city's Hillside neighborhood and his struggles as he entered into public life. He is a lanky figure at 6'3", and while laconic, he has a natural talent for politics. He was student body president at UMD, won a seat on the city council at 25, and was elected mayor at 33. In his re-election run 4 years later, he was the first mayor in more than a century to face no opposition. He decided not to run for a third term, mainly to raise the three young children he had with his wife Laura, and, I presume, to earn money before possibly re-entering politics at some later stage. Deb and I met the Nesses for dinner at one of the many popular restaurants in Canal Park, a gathering spot for tourists and natives alike, surrounded by water. Every 3 or 4 minutes as we spoke, a Duluther would come by to say hello to both of them. The first time I'd met Ness 2 years earlier on another aviation-related visit to the city, he had told me that being a mayor, especially in a strong mayor city system, was the best job current American politics had to offer. It's a job that requires and allows you to create and implement a tangible agenda, he told me. You can carry that out in a way that most positions in American politics just don't permit. 1 minute you can be crafting a broader vision on economic development strategy. In the next minute you're responding to a snowplow complaint. And it grounds you in what is happening in the community. And hopefully you can translate that into a broader concept. This time, I asked him whether more years in office and more experience in politics had changed his view. "Not really," he said. "As mayor, I tried to convey a message that helped folks forge an emotional bond with